Well, welcome, everyone. This is Jay Pendergrass, Vice President for Programs and Publications at the Environmental Law Institute. I want to welcome you all to the February climate change briefing for the Environmental Law Institute. We have speakers today, Vicky Arroyo, Executive Director of the Climate Center at Georgetown University, Michael Girard, Professor at Columbia Law School and Director of the Center for Climate Change Law, Monique Roy, Director of Political Assessment at ClimateWorks Foundation, and Robert Sussman, Principal of Sussman & Associates. And today we're going to start with Nikki.
Great. Thanks, Jay. I thought I'd give a quick report on sort of an after-action summary of what happened in the appropriations fight. I think most listeners know that there was a big showdown between the president and the congressional leadership over the appropriations bills towards the end of last year. And one of the big pivotal issues I would say the president prevailed on had to do with environmental riders. And so we have secured a list of the riders that had been put forth by the congressional leadership. And let me just run through the list and then say a couple of things about what wasn't on the list, which I think is interesting as well. There were riders, and by riders I mean language on the appropriations bills that primarily by choking off funding for a certain federal activity would have the effect of, you know, blocking a regulation or a law or a guidance or something like that. So there were provisions in here blocking federal enforcement of the Clean Power Plan, which I think everybody is expecting, restricting EPA from using the social cost of carbon in rulemaking and guidance documents, preventing the use of a standard accounting for climate change impacts in NEPA reviews of federal agency decisions, prohibiting the Treasury Department from voting against international development projects to build new coal-fired power plants, similarly prohibiting implementation of the administration's OPICs and the World Bank's climate rules and policies, prohibiting the U.S. from negotiating or entering into a trade agreement that established a limit on greenhouse gases, requiring that all biomasses be treated as carbon neutral. That's a little different. That one sort of reached in and didn't stop funding of something. It actually reached in and required certain treatment of biomasses, restrict EPA's change of status of HFCs as refrigerants or blowing agents from acceptable to unacceptable. So EPA was trying to, very sorry about this noise, folks. Okay. So EPA was trying to change the status of HFCs to unacceptable. This would have kept EPA from doing that. Allowing DOD to use fuels with a high greenhouse gas content, blocking funds for the completion of a transmission line that would take renewable energy generated electricity from Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas to Tennessee and Arkansas, blocking BLM's new fracking rule for groundwater and surface water. And then there were three measures, and everything I just mentioned there was rejected. The administration, I think largely because of the presidential, because of the sort of wide-ranging nature of the presidential race, had sort of the upper hand with the congressional leadership and prevailed on all these. But then there are also three measures prohibiting, three measures that dealt with the federal flood risk management standard, one of which was accepted with some modifications. So that's one example of the more traditional approach, which is where there was something that was worked out between the administration and Congress. Interestingly, absent from this list, and to my surprise, frankly, there's nothing. The vehicle heavy-duty vehicle standards were a provision that would block EPA's moving forward on the heavy-duty vehicle standards or even the light-duty standards, not on the list, which I thought was interesting. Appliance standards, or at least I'm not familiar, I didn't see on the list anything blocking DOE from doing appliance standards. There was actually a provision that that was added to one of the earlier bills that dealt with ceiling fans. I don't believe that made it on. I could be wrong, but didn't see it on this list. I think it's because my guess is that industrial supporters of they're business voices on both sides of these issues, and that sort of neutralized the place where congressional leadership was. In the end, like I say, all of these provisions were dropped, but it's sort of interesting to see what made the list. And that's my report for today, Jay.
Thank you, Nikki. Mike?
Thank you, Jay. Here's my litigation report. On January 21, the D.C. Circuit denied motions asking for a stay of EPA's Clean Power Plan. The order stated that the petitioners had not satisfied the stringent requirements for a stay pending court review, but didn't say anything beyond that. The court also ordered that consideration of the appeals be expedited. It set oral argument for June 2nd, and the court asked the parties also to reserve June 3 in the event that the argument took 2 days. The order indicated that the members of the panel that will handle this appeal, which had not previously been announced, are Judges Judith Rogers, who was appointed by President Bill Clinton, Karen LaCraft Henderson, who was appointed by President George H.W. Bush, and Sri Srinivasan, appointed by President Obama. The general sense is that that's a pretty good panel for EPA. On January 28th, the court set the briefing schedule. The schedule required submission of the petitioner's briefs by February 19, EPA's brief by March 28, and final briefs by April 22nd. After the D.C. Circuit denied the stay, a group of 29 states and state agencies, led by West Virginia and Texas, filed an application for an immediate stay with the Supreme Court. That application was joined by applications from business associations, from the coal industry, from utility and allied parties, and from North Dakota. The applications are directed to Chief Justice John Roberts, who's the Circuit Justice for the D.C. Circuit. Chief Justice Roberts asked for and received EPA's response by February 4, and we now await the outcome. An oral argument in that is not expected. On January 25, the Supreme Court issued an important decision that does not directly mention climate change, but that nonetheless has important implications. The case involved a rule issued by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, called FERC Order 745, concerning demand response, the system under which some large electricity customers agree in advance to curtail their usage when requested, usually at peak times, and get compensated for doing so. FERC had set the rates at which users would be compensated, but the D.C. Circuit invalidated that rule because it would affect retail rates, which is exclusively the job of the states. FERC can set wholesale rates, but not retail rates. The Supreme Court has now reversed the D.C. Circuit decision and reinstated the demand response program. The Supreme Court found that FERC is free to take actions that have the effect of influencing retail rates, provided the actions are primarily aimed at the wholesale level. Justice Kagan wrote the 6-2 decision for the majority. She wrote, quote, "It is a fact of economic life that the wholesale and retail markets in electricity, as in every other known product, are not hermetically sealed from each other. To the contrary, transactions that occur on the wholesale market have natural consequences at the retail level. So, too, of necessity, will FERC's regulation of those wholesale matters." The case is called FERC versus Electric Power Supply Corporation. Demand response programs help renewable energy because intermittent resources like wind and solar need ways to lower the peaks of electricity demand. Beyond that, as the electricity system transitions to renewables and other technologies, it'll be important for FERC to have the ability to adopt a number of rules to facilitate these technologies. And the new decision greatly reduces the risk that some of these rules will be found to be exceeding FERC's authority. In other Supreme Court action, the court denied a petition for cert from the Energy Intensive Manufacturers Working Group on Greenhouse Gas Reduction. They sought review of the D.C. Circuit's order governing further proceedings after the Supreme Court's 2014 decision in Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA. In its April 2015 order, the D.C. Circuit did not vacate EPA's regulations concerning greenhouse gas permitting for stationary sources in their entirety. Instead, the D.C. Circuit ordered EPA to rescind only the portions of the regulations that required permits based solely on a source's greenhouse gas emissions, but left in place regulations that required sources subject to the prevention of significant deterioration requirements due to other types of emissions, often referred to as the anyway sources, to use best available control technology to control greenhouse gas emissions. Finally, the Federal District Court for the District of Oregon allowed the National Association of Manufacturers, the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, and the American Petroleum Institute to intervene as of right in a climate change lawsuit brought by a number of individual plaintiffs aged 19 or younger, an environmental organization, and a plaintiff identified as, quote, future generations, close quote. The plaintiffs allege that the federal government's actions and failures to take actions deprive the plaintiffs of constitutionally protected rights by allowing dangerous levels of carbon to accumulate in the atmosphere. The court found that these trade associations had a significantly protectable interest because the relief sought by the plaintiffs would change the very nature of their business. The court also said that there was no question that the proposed intervener's interests would be impaired by any court-mandated regulation to eliminate emissions, and that the intervener's presence was necessary to fully and fairly put those issues before the court. The court was not persuaded by the plaintiff's contention that the government was essentially pro-fossil fuel industry and would adequately represent the interests of these trade associations. That case is called Juliana versus United States, and that's my litigation report.
Thank you, Mike. Next, we'll move to Vicki.
So, thank you. Hi, everybody. Here's some of the updates that are happening in the state. In New York, Governor Cuomo has proposed ambitious climate initiatives for 2016, including proposing a $5 billion clean energy fund and closing the state's remaining coal plants. In his January 13th State of the State address, he directed the PSC to phase out the state's two coal plants by 2020. And the proposal included $19 million for job training and assistance that would be affected for the communities that would be affected by the plant closures. He also included in the State of the State new renewable energy and efficiency proposals aimed at supplying efficiency improvements to 500,000 homes and 20,000 businesses by 2020, and constructing 300 additional wind turbines in the state. New York's also advanced another one of his climate change objectives that we've discussed before when the state PSC approved the $5 billion clean energy fund at its January 21st meeting. The investments are expected to reduce residential and business customer bills $39 billion over the next 10 years. In California, the PUC, for the first time, has loosened some of the restrictions that existed before on utilities installing electric vehicle charging stations in the state. So in January, the California PUC approved San Diego Gas and Electric's plan to install up to 3,500 EV charging stations in its service area. And earlier last month, on January 15th, the PUC approved a proposal by Southern California Edison to install 1,500 EV charging stations in its Los Angeles service area. Under the proposal, Southern California Edison will build the infrastructure up to the charging stations, but private companies will install the charging boxes. And so these pilot programs are designed to move California closer to achieving Governor Brown's goal of having 2.5 million zero-emission vehicles, or ZEVs, on the road in California by 2025. Under both programs, at least 10% of the chargers must be installed in disadvantaged communities. An update on net metering in Nevada. The Nevada Public Utility Commission is scheduled to review its December decision that added fees and reduced payments to rooftop solar customers. In December, the Nevada PUC approved a proposal backed by the utility Nevada Energy to alter the state's net metering program, and that would have raised monthly fees for rooftop solar customers and decreased the rates paid for the energy sold back to the grid. But distributed solar providers in the state responded by laying hundreds of workers following the PUC decision. And on January 25th, Nevada Energy announced that it would propose grandfathering existing customers under the previous net metering policy. In California, the PUC voted to preserve the state's net metering rate structure. On January 28th, the PUC voted to continue paying rooftop solar customers of the three investor-owned utilities the full retail rate for excess energy. They had proposed lower rates and higher fees for customers, but these proposals were rejected by the PUC. They did, however, impose a one-time interconnection fee on customers. The proceeds of this $150 fee will be used to fund low-income and efficiency programs. In Pennsylvania, Governor Wolf proposed regulations to reduce methane emissions from oil and gas wells. On January 19th, he announced these new regulations to reduce methane leaks from the operations, saying that the regulations will improve, quote, our air and address the urgent crisis of climate change, unquote. And he emphasized that businesses would reclaim the product, which is now being wasted, when that methane is lost. The announced regulation will target new and existing sources with the goal of reducing the state's methane emissions by 40%. You might recall that in last month's report, we mentioned that the Washington State Department of Ecology is moving forward with its Clean Air Rule, a plan to cap and reduce carbon emissions from large sources under the governor's orders, even though they didn't have legislation. And one of the provisions said that they would be able to accept emissions allowances for RGGI to meet that standard. However, of course, RGGI needs to buy into that. So in January, on January 26th, the RGGI folks announced a statement saying that RGGI states are evaluating this provision of Washington draft proposal, noting that the proposed use of RGGI allowances outside the area raises substantive issues. Of course, allowing Washington, or other places for that matter, to use carbon allowances from their market might affect their cap and lead to higher prices in the region, so they're investigating that. Just a heads up on two bills. It's early days, but there are two significant climate bills to watch being proposed in Oregon. One is HB 4036, the Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Plan. That would eliminate coal-fired electricity generation by 2035 and establish a 50% renewable energy mandate for 2050. And then they also have Senate Bill 1574, the Healthy Climate Act, which would establish an economy-wide cap on greenhouse gas emissions, auction allowances, and allow for trading similar to California's AB 32. So those are both in committee still. On the resilience front, I just want to make you aware that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development awarded $1 billion in resilience funding to states and cities through the National Disaster Resilience Competition. Awards were given to 8 states and 5 cities. They'll fund housing and infrastructure projects that increase resilience to natural disasters and the impacts of climate change. They also focus on supporting resilience specifically in low and moderate income communities. Some of the places that received awards are New Orleans, my hometown, New York State, Springfield, Massachusetts, and California. That's the news from the state.
Thank you, Vicki. And now we'll move to Bob.
Yeah, I'd like to report on a recent legal analysis of the potential to use Section 115 of the Clean Air Act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This analysis was done jointly by the Columbia Law School Center of Climate Change Law, which is Mike Gerard's organization, the Emmett Institute at UCLA Law School, and the Institute for Policy Integrity at NYU Law School. The subject of Section 115 is not a new one. It's been the subject of analysis and discussion over the last couple of years, including a 2013 petition to EPA to invoke Section 115. This new analysis is important first because it's comprehensive and well researched. Secondly, because it was not only developed by three important centers of climate change law, but endorsed by a group of the nation's leading experts on climate change law, and finally, because it brings to bear in the discussion the recent agreement at the Paris COP at the end of 2015, and the implications of that agreement for the application of Section 115. Section 115 is entitled International Air Pollution, and it basically gives the administrator of EPA the ability to address and reduce U.S. emissions that are harming public health or the environment outside of the U.S. There are two preconditions for invoking Section 115. One of them is a finding that U.S. emissions are contributing to air pollution that endangers public health or welfare in another country. This is the so-called endangerment finding. And secondly, that the administrator determines that the other country provides, quote, essentially the same rights with respect to the prevention or control of air pollution occurring in that country as is given that country by Section 115. And this is basically termed the reciprocity determination. If EPA makes those two findings, then it is empowered to order the various states responsible for the emission to amend their state implementation plans under Section 110 to include requirements to prevent or eliminate the pollution that is contributing to the endangerment. A couple of points here. One, the article says that it's pretty easy for EPA to make the endangerment finding required by Section 115, and I certainly agree with that, given the earlier endangerment finding that EPA made and the agency's success in withstanding judicial challenges. The article also argues that the reciprocity determination is relatively easy to make as well, given the many aspects of joint and cooperative international action that are occurring on climate change, including most notably the INDCs that were enshrined in the recent Paris Agreement. I think that's an interesting argument, but one that is subject to debate. The final point I would make here about the article is that it highlights the benefits of Section 115 in potentially authorizing an economy-wide 50-state multi-sector cap-and-trade program. And it contrasts those benefits of Section 115 with the path that EPA would otherwise have to follow in using Section 111 and other authorities to regulate greenhouse gases on a sector by sector basis. And so I would say, as we look to the future and perhaps to the next administration, and how that administration might achieve the U.S. INDC of a 26 to 28% reduction, Section 115 definitely needs to be in the mix and needs a close look, whether you think it's a panacea or not. So let me stop there. Mike, do you want to comment briefly on the analysis?
Sure, Bob. I basically agree with what you said. Just a couple of things I would add. As you pointed out, it could apply to all sectors of the economy, whereas 111D, obviously, you have to do sector by sector. 115 does not have the sort of technical issues that are being litigated so ferociously in the 111D context. We don't have an issue with warring Senate and House language. We don't have the same kinds of system of emission reduction requirements. There are lots of advantages to it. So one way that it might work, were the next president to follow it. Yeah, I mean, there's not enough time left in the Obama presidency to do it, but if we had a President Hillary Clinton or a President Bernie Sanders, one could imagine essentially a SIP call going out to all 50 states, EPA giving each state an objective of how much reduction in greenhouse gases it needed to achieve, giving the states quite a bit of flexibility on how to achieve that, including giving them the option of setting up a trading platform that would allow the lowest cost emission reductions to be achieved. So I think all of that is feasible under the current statute. I'm sure that people would challenge it in court, but I think that it has a lot of potential.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, and a particular thanks to Bob for joining us for the first time. And we will look forward to our next call on March 14th. So until then, thank you very much.